Is the podium on the right there slightly?
I didn't know that feature was here.
Thank you.
Sounds like I'm getting feedback. That was my concern. Thank you. This case arises out of the defendant's failure to comply with the terms of an escrow agreement. As alleged, Justine Lyons and her longtime domestic partner, Alfred Ducharme, came to an agreement under which Mr. Charme would sell Vermont property that he owned and then turn the proceeds over to Ms. Lyons. This was intended to compensate her for the many years of financial support that she provided for him. Mr. Ducharme found a buyer.
Well, actually, the agreement that they had was that they were going to pool their resources and then buy a house together, and then she was going to keep the remainder, right?
That's right, but she would also be a co-owner of the house. And
the house that they eventually bought.
That's right.
And that couldn't really happen because he died.
Well, that's
so. So we don't know actually what would have happened with that money. But did the defendants, the lawyers in this case, did they know that Mr. Ducharme and Ms. Lyons had this agreement about what to do with their money, or they were just given wire instructions to send the money to her account?
Well, the wire instructions are all they needed because the terms of an escrow agreement are required to be strictly complied with. There's no waiting until...
But if you get wire instructions that just says send the money to this account, how do you know that that's some kind of agreement as opposed to just, you know, an account where you're parking the funds?
It was identified as an account belonging to Justine Lyons, and really it shouldn't have been any concern of theirs as to who the owner of the account was. They had to just comply with those instructions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's not their concern who the owner of the account was. They're not investigating what deal Ducharme had with Lyons. They're just following Ducharme's instructions to send the proceeds to that account, right?
That's right.
So then once the wire transfer fails and can't go through, they don't have instructions from Mr. Ducharme anymore, right?
Well, first of all, under the purchase and sale agreement, there's to be a simultaneous exchange of consideration across a conference table, as it typically happens. That didn't happen here. Originally, the closing was set for December 23rd. By agreement of the parties, it was moved to December 24th. Defendant Schofield accepted the signed deed, went ahead and recorded it that morning, and only that afternoon, well, she then attempted to wire the proceeds and failed in her attempt to do so for reasons that remain unclear. And only then...
But there are no allegations of any intentionality as to that failure, right? There's no suggestion that it was a circumvention of the instructions that had been given.
Well, the instructions provided that the exchange was to be simultaneous because the instructions were pursuant to the purchase and sale agreement that so provided. So with that simultaneous exchange of consideration, hand the signed deed, hand the check, the way it typically would happen. Or if you're not using a check, then at least wire the money at that time. But she went ahead and recorded the deed, then later attempted to wire the proceeds. When that failed, it's Christmas Eve already, it's 1:40 in the afternoon, she attempted to email Defendant Birmingham to tell him that the transfer had failed. And she was only able to get through to his office, I guess, because it was the holiday weekend coming up, and it was a long holiday weekend. Christmas was on Friday, and the closing occurred on a Thursday. And, you know, tragically and very unexpectedly, Mr. Ducharme died the day after Christmas. Even when the an escrow principle has passed, you're still required to complete the terms of the escrow. This is just basic black letter law about escrow agreements going back into the 1800s.
But what instructions in the escrow agreement were not fulfilled?
Well, the funds were not passed over to Ms. Lyons or put into her account.
Because
the
information provided for the transfer was incorrect. Didn't work. Yeah.
Right. Well, and then they kept the funds over through the long holiday weekend. The following Monday, I believe it was, Mr. Birmingham communicated with Ms. Schofield and informed her of the death of his client and had her transfer the funds into his trust account. It's difficult to understand what authority he may be acting under because his power of attorney is the only thing that authorizes to act on behalf of Mr. Ducharme expired at the moment of Mr. Ducharme's death. So he's holding these funds and knowing that Justine Lyons is the beneficiary of that transaction, didn't turn them over to her, held them for 3 months.
How would he know that? I mean, is it true that she was the beneficiary? Again, the question is what the ultimate arrangement was, and how would he know what the arrangement was?
Well, because the wire instructions actually identify her as the account holder.
Yeah, the wire instructions identify her as the account holder of the account to which she's transferring the funds.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
It identifies her as the account holder of the account to which she gave instructions to wire the funds.
Right.
That doesn't tell you that she's a beneficiary of the funds. It doesn't tell you that I have sold this house and I want all the proceeds to go to this person. He just means I want the proceeds to be wired into this account. Well, maybe she was going to do something on his behalf after getting the funds, and the whole understanding was they remained in his funds. I mean, how would the lawyers know that she's a beneficiary? I'm not even sure, even given all of this record, I can make a definitive statement that she was the beneficiary of the funds. I know, as you've said, they have an agreement to pool their funds and buy a house, and she was understood to take the remainder, but if that doesn't happen, I'm not sure who's supposed to own all the pooled funds if there's no purchase. So how were the lawyers supposed to know under these circumstances?
Well, because this was dismissed on a motion to dismiss, all facts are required to be construed in Ms. Lyons' favor. The allegation is that those funds were for her benefit. Whether the...
But that's not a fact. That's a legal conclusion, whether she's the beneficiary of the transaction. So what are and you're saying the facts that would show that, the lawyers would know that, is just her name on the wire instructions as the owner of an account to which the funds were going to be wired.
And it's also all of the allegations that she claims in the complaint that that was the deal, whether the lawyers knew about it or not.
But under those allegations, under the allegations that you've articulated, isn't his estate entitled to at least some of those funds? As you've articulated it, yes or no?
No, because if they had gone through with the purchase of the house, they would have both owned that house together. She would have owned any excess proceeds.
But that purchase hadn't happened yet.
No, it hadn't happened, right. But that was their deal. That was what they were going to do. She was going to have something. And if there needs to be some litigation about what the amount of that benefit to her should be, we can have discussion
about
that.
So again, to my question, even under the theory that you've articulated, aren't some of those funds... Wouldn't his estate be entitled to some of those funds, at least arguably?
Well, there is litigation ongoing in Connecticut over the issue, and because there was a dismissal on personal jurisdiction grounds of the case against the defendants in the Vermont case, we opted to file suit against them in their domicile state, and so that's why we're here. And if this case were to proceed to... if you were to reverse and remand and there were something that was to happen in Connecticut, I think the appropriate action would be to stay the Vermont case and let it play out in Connecticut. But in the meantime, we needed to do something to ensure that these claims would not be time barred against these two defendants. And in fact, if the statute of limitations, if we hadn't filed, would have only recently expired.
But there's going to be determination in the probate court as to who owns the funds, right?
There will be eventually, yeah.
And wouldn't that determination be determinative of this?
There's other damages apart from just ownership of the funds, including
the time value of the money,
and the time value of 3 years of month at $378,000. So I believe I attempted to reserve time. I'm going to.
No, that's okay. You'll still have the reserve time.
Okay.
I guess I have one other question, which is.
Sure.
So even assuming that there was a showing of ownership, the district court assumed that there was there on the part of the lawyers the kind of exercise of dominion over the funds that we associate with conversion? I mean, they did not keep it for themselves, and they transferred it to the estate to be held in escrow to be determined by for ownership to be determined by the probate court.
Well,
that's not usually what somebody who steals money would do, right?
You don't have to keep it for yourself. I mean, you could think of a circumstance where a thief steals something and gives it away to somebody else, but he wouldn't be liable for conversion in that instance. And conversion in Vermont law, the case is P.F. Jerks, it's not just if it's for their own benefit, but it's also if they're just asserting a claim title that's inconsistent with the owner's title. Or if there's...
But they didn't make a claim of title, right? They didn't say this is our money. And they didn't even say it belongs to the estate or it belongs to anybody. They said the ownership is disputed, and so therefore I'm going to submit the money to this probate process.
But by not recognizing her title to the proceeds, it's inconsistent with her title, and that is the basis for the... But when you fail to follow the terms of an escrow agreement, a claim for professional negligence at the very
least. Counsel, following up to Judge Menasche's question, how did the district court err in considering the defendant's intent in good faith, seeing that both intent and good faith are factors identified under the restatement for conversion? I mean, the district court found there was good faith on the part of the lawyers here putting the money in escrow. So how do you make a conversion claim out of that?
I'm not sure how the court could have made a finding of good faith, because intent is a fact issue that goes to a jury, and for the court to have done that based on...
Other than your client's name on the account in the wire instructions, was there any other piece of evidence to suggest that the lawyer said any information that this money belonged to her?
Well, Your Honors, it's very early in the case. We haven't had any discovery yet.
Well, what allegations of lack of good faith are there in the complaint?
There are no allegations of lack of good faith in the complaint, but it's a claim of professional negligence. So good faith, when you're strictly required to follow the terms of an escrow agreement, good faith is irrelevant.
Well, on conversion, it's relevant, isn't it?
In conversion, it's relevant if you're looking at even deciding whether there was a conversion, but it's in this case where the party's actually been deprived of the funds and is claiming ownership, and the judge has even ruled for purposes of the motion that there's an ownership interest for purposes of the conversion action. It's puzzling to us why it wasn't also so for...
In terms of professional responsibility, your client wasn't a client of the counsel, any counsel.
No.
Correct?
You can see that. You can be a third-party beneficiary of an attorney-client relationship.
Well, but then that comes back to whether she really was a third-party beneficiary. But in terms of professional responsibility, they didn't owe her a duty as a direct client. Would you concede that?
No.
She wasn't a client.
Under Rules 1.15 of my Rules of Professional Conduct, lawyers are required to safeguard property of third parties that comes into their possession.
Right. That's not my question, though. My question is, was she a client? Do you concede that she was not a client of any one of these attorneys?
She was not a client.
Does she have a claim for a breach of this escrow agreement?
No, because it's sort of folded into the professional responsibility claim. It was a breach of the escrow agreement that gives rise to that negligence action.
Do you think you could file a claim for a breach of the escrow agreement?
I think it's possible at this point, but we hadn't thought of it when we first filed. It's typical under Vermont law, if you had a beneficiary of a will, for instance, they're a third-party beneficiary of the attorney-client relationship. And so that's a similar circumstance here. They don't sue for breach of contract. They sue for breach of professional obligations.
But in that case, there would be a will that would identify someone as a beneficiary. Here,
right.
There's nothing other than the account, correct?
The
name
in
the account.
Escrow instructions, yes.
Okay, Mr. Bond, you reserved time for rebuttal, so we'll hear from you again.
Thank you.
But let's turn to the first appellee, Mr. Max.
Thank you. Need to be taller. Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. First, I want to say it's my pleasure and honor to be here on behalf of my longtime colleague and friend, Attorney Matt Birmingham, and his firm. I first would like to say that Judge Sessions entered a very thorough and accurate opinion and order based on the facts that are in the complaint. This court will do a de novo review of those facts and accept them all as true, which is what Judge Sessions did. It'll be the facts that are within the complaint. And I say that for a couple of reasons. One, there is no allegation of an escrow agreement. There are no terms of an escrow agreement. There is nothing for the lawyers in this case to look to review for an escrow agreement to find out where these funds were to go to. There was just wiring instructions. And as the justice alluded to earlier this morning,
The one question with respect to the conversion claim is whether the allegation of the instructions creates a plausible inference of a legal entitlement to the funds by the appellant.
And I would respectfully suggest that it doesn't, Your Honor, because it merely tells where these funds are to go to while Mr. Ducharme is alive. It doesn't say what's to become of those funds. Those funds then go to an account, and from where they go to that account, there is no instruction, no indication, no knowledge.
So would it have been permissible for Mr. Birmingham to transfer the funds to Lyons?
It would have been if those funds were transferable while he was still alive. Those funds came back to Attorney Birmingham after he had passed away, which means that Mr. Ducharme no longer owned those funds.
I know this didn't happen, and maybe he didn't have to do it this way, but if Mr. Birmingham had said, well, look, the last instructions I have from Mr. Ducharme were to transfer the funds to Ms. Lyons, so I'm going to transfer the funds to Ms. Lyons. Would that have been permissible?
It would not have been permissible at the time because, again, Mr. Ducharme had passed away. So the owner of those funds, despite the untimeliness of his passing, the owner of those funds were the estate, and they were not Mr. Ducharme's, they were not Ms. Lyons'. So if he had transferred those to Ms. Lyons, she was not entitled to those funds any longer.
But so you're saying that even if the wire transfer had been accomplished and the funds were sitting in Ms. Lyons' account, they still would have been the property of the estate?
No, because, if the funds were timely transferred while he was still alive, then they would have been the property of Ms. Lyons in that account. Where to go, nobody knows, because as has been noted, the allegation that they were supposed to pool these funds for a home was not known to any of the lawyers here. There's nothing in writing to say that.
So the estate might have made a claim on the funds even if they were sitting in Ms. Lyons' account.
Then the estate would have been making the claim for the disputed funds, not Ms. Lyons. Now those funds rest in a trust account with the lawyer for the estate, and they're under dispute in Connecticut.
Interesting you mentioned timely. Why did the Birmingham defendants not respond to the Schofield defendants' communication regarding the failed wire transfer? I mean, there was a period of what? 3 days. I mean, I understand it was holiday. The closing was on December 23rd. He passed on December 26th, but there was no communication about the wire transfer. Why is that? Because you said timely. If the funds come in timely, then they would have had a claim, or possibly a claim.
Attorney Birmingham simply was not in the office, and he was not monitoring his emails. It was over Christmas, and that was the reason that he did not hear and contact Attorney Schofield until after the 26th.
When did Lyons first contact the defendants regarding her claim to the proceeds? Do you know when that occurred?
That contact, I believe, Your Honor, occurred in Connecticut when it was learned that when there was an estate set up and the estate demanded that the funds go to them. And then I believe that's when Attorney Lyons
initiated. Do you know when that was? Not where, but when?
It was after after Mr. Ducharme had passed away.
And so he contacts Schofield on the 28th and says Ducharme has passed away, send the money here. But then he sits on it until mid-February when he gets contacted by the estate, right?
Because the estate in Connecticut, the administrator was not appointed until February of 2021.
So you're saying he was waiting for the administrators to be appointed?
Correct. There had to be an estate. Administrators had to be appointed.
And your position is he could not have transferred the money to Lyons at that point because that would have been inconsistent with the ownership of the funds.
The ownership of the funds were with the estate because of the untimely passing.
Mr. Bond made this point that said, Mr. Birmingham's power of attorney had expired upon Mr. Ducharme's death, so he actually couldn't ask for the money to go anywhere. Do you have a response to that?
Mr. Birmingham did not own the funds at that point. Those funds were Mr. Ducharme's because he sold the property. So he was the benefit. He received the purchase price as the seller. He passed away. Those funds became part of his estate. So the estate was the lawful owner to be held in escrow while this dispute played out in Connecticut and then here in Vermont.
So if the ownership of the funds were in dispute, as Mr. Birmingham learned when he heard from the estate, why not do an interpleader action as opposed to transferring it to the estate, which is one of the claimants?
because the estate was pending in Connecticut, and the funds were here, and there was actions already being threatened or in underway in the estate down in Connecticut. So,
so that would,
isn't
was
that
a more
classically
efficient
an interpleader?
It could
have a conflict over who's you have conflicting accounts of who's entitled to the funds.
Correct. And his professional duty was to put the funds in an escrow account while this conflict played itself out, whether by interpleader or claims against the estate down in Connecticut. He was not obligated. It would have been unethical for him to give those funds to one party or the other. So they placed with the estate for the probate court to determine ownership.
But one of the parties is the estate, right?
Correct.
So he did give it to one of the parties.
The beneficiaries of the estate. The estate holds the money, and then the beneficiaries.
But so I take it from your response, he could have filed an interpleader, but the probate process was also a way of resolving ownership of the funds, and so he could have done either one. Is that your position?
Absolutely.
It wouldn't have been wrong for him to do an interpleader in Vermont, but he decided it was more efficient to have it go through the probate process.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Mass. We'll
thank you very much.
To the second appellee, Ms. Devine.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Laura Devine, and I'm here on behalf of Attorney Mary Lou Schofield and Mary Lou Schofield's PC. And we echo the arguments that were made by co-counsel. Here, the District of Vermont determined that Ms. Lyons failed to state a claim under Rule 12b-6 against the defendants, the appellees, for conversion and for professional negligence. We ask that this court today affirm that ruling. The court had properly stated the standard for a motion to dismiss and construed all facts in the light most favorable to Ms. Lyons. This case at its core is a real estate transaction. The buyer and seller were both represented by counsel, the appellees here. Ms. Lyons was not a party to the sale. There is no document in the appendix that constitutes a contract where Ms. Lyons is involved at all. She was not on the deed of the
seller
property.
Did provide instructions that said that the proceeds should be wired to Ms. Lyons, right?
There is a single page document that's not considered incorporated by reference or an addendum to or incorporated as a part of the contract.
No,
it's
but
a separate
there, there's an allegation that she was that the instructions were to wire to her, right?
There's a one page document that's called wiring instructions. And that document identifies an account number and an account routing code, and it says beneficiary name, and Justine Lyons' name is there. And that's the beneficiary of that account as a part of the wiring.
Okay, so Ms. Schofield received instructions that once she has the proceeds of the sale, she should transfer the proceeds to Ms. Lyons, right?
That she should transfer the proceeds to that account.
To that account.
Correct.
And so you're saying that once the wire transfer didn't succeed, then she had no instructions and didn't know what to do?
Correct.
But why shouldn't she have understood those instructions as being an instruction to transfer it to Ms. Lyons, since she is on that sheet as the beneficiary?
Well, because at that point, Attorney Schofield's obligation was to her client, the buyer of the real estate, and to ensure that the real estate transaction went through. In Vermont, the statute of frauds governs real estate transactions. This case would have been different if Ms. Lyons' name was on the deed of the property or if she was a part of the purchase and sale agreement, which she was not. It's a separate piece of paper.
Are you saying, had there not been a death, it would not have been permissible to transfer the funds to Ms. Lyons?
Had there not been a death, it would have been Mr. Ducharme who would have been able to, through counsel, advise as to where that money should be wired. And part of that, with respect to the statute of frauds, is that those funds, the proceeds, as someone who was on the deed and the purchase and sale, they belong to him. So technically, he could have changed his mind at any point. If the wiring instructions failed, he could have said, and this is speculative, but he could have said, you know what, just wire them to my account. We'll use that account to purchase this new property and then divide up the proceeds. Until that wire went through, it's anybody's guess as to what would have happened. But what's not anybody's guess is that the proceeds under the statute of frauds, Attorney Schofield had to comply with her duties to her client to make sure that the funds went to the seller of the property, which was Mr. Ducharme on the deed and on the purchase and sale agreement.
Did Ms. Schofield or Mr. Birmingham know about the arrangement between Lyons and Ducharme to pool their funds and buy a new house?
My understanding is that Attorney Schofield had no idea about that, and there are no documents to support that. The only name where Justine Lyons appears is that single-page document, which actually may not be a part of the appendix that's before the court today. I had filed in my supplemental appendix the memorandum of law in support of my motion to dismiss. For space reasons, I excluded the exhibits, but when I went through the appendix to prepare for today, I don't think that single page made it into the appendix, and we can, if the court needs that document.
I mean, what matters are the allegations. You don't refute the there's no conflict that the document is consistent, I guess, with the allegations that the wire instructions included identifying Ms. Lyons as the account owner to which the funds were to be transferred, right?
Correct.
And do you know why the wire transfer didn't succeed?
I don't.
Okay.
I do know that as it was Christmas Eve, I think that there may have been issues with the like hours of the banking institutions involved in terms of why the wire transfer didn't like continue on throughout that weekend. I know that in the appellant's brief, it was noted that the closing actually occurred on December 24th, and then that email was at 1:40 p.m., and I think there were issues with the hours of the banking and then the hours related to Christmas. And the long weekend that Christmas fell on.
And then Mr. Ducharme passed away unexpectedly 2 days later.
That's my understanding.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Devine. We'll turn back to Mr. Bond on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. As my sister correctly observed, nobody knows what happened. It could have been somebody simply misinputting a single number in the routing number or the account number, but we don't, and if that's the case, then I think the claim for professional negligence should stand.
Counsel, are you saying that it was from Attorney Schofield's office, a misplacement of a number that the wire didn't go through because the account number was wrong?
I'm saying we don't know. It could have happened anywhere along that.
So time. You're disputing, did you not put in your brief or in your submissions that the closing went through on the 24th and that the wire transfer went through at 1:40 p.m.
No.
On Christmas Eve, and that might have been a reason why it wasn't accepted?
No, we don't know what time she attempted to make the wire transfer at this point.
Okay.
It was her.
So you're speculating when you're saying the reason the wire transfer didn't go through is because there was an incorrect account number.
I'm saying that
placed by either the Birmingham firm or the Schofield firm.
That is a possibility.
It could have been a mistake on the bank's end, receiving the wire and putting in a wrong number, right?
Right.
But you're not speculating on that?
No.
Being the error?
No, we don't have that information, but defendant Schofield's obligation was to strictly comply with the terms of the escrow. And her obligation did not run just to her client, but to all parties to the escrow. So that's, and the escrow agreement survives the death of the, of Mr. Ducharme as well. So if those funds had been timely transferred, of course, nobody would have been here, even if Mr. Ducharme had passed away, because Ms. Lyons would be the possessor of those funds as holder of the account.
Well, she would be the possessor, but do you dispute that the estate could have come along and said, actually, you're not the owner of these funds?
No, well, then it would have been argued in the probate court that it was an inter vivos gift or even the bringing up the contract.
Right, so you would have had the same arguments that you're now making in probate court.
Right.
Regardless of whether it had been transferred to her or not.
Right.
You argued that an interpleader action should have been filed.
Yes.
And if that were the case, you wouldn't have a claim for conversion or professional liability.
That's right.
So what is the practical, I guess two questions, what's the practical difference between the probate court managing the determination of who owns these funds or the allocation of these funds? What's the practical difference? And number two, do you have any authority for the idea that allowing probate as opposed to an interpleader action makes some material difference?
Well, the interpleader action would be focused on this one single issue, and it would be much more streamlined as a result. I believe it would be a more efficient way of dealing with the claims.
I see. So the absence of efficiency leads to a conversion claim?
No, I'm not saying that. But the fact that the funds were not put into her possession when she was entitled to have them put into her possession, and the mandate to be done.
But that would be true if an interpleader had been filed, right?
Well, then we wouldn't be complaining
but you just said
about
that
professional
actually,
negligence.
Actually, so. It's not clear that it was entitled to be put in her possession, because regardless of whether the funds were transferred to her account or not, there would have been the same proceeding in the probate court where there was a dispute over the ownership.
I don't know about that, Your Honor.
You said that just a moment ago.
Well, there may have been. Anybody can bring a case in court, but whether the case has merit or not is a totally different issue. And I don't think if there had been a transfer between them while Ms. Lyons was still alive, then
the estate is not claiming that they own the funds because they didn't happen to get transferred into her account at the last minute. They're claiming they own the funds because they belong to Ducharme, and they didn't buy a house together, and so there hasn't been an agreement that she's the owner, right?
Well, buying the house together, all that down the road stuff, that doesn't matter. All that matters is putting her in possession of the funds, and then it's her bank account, and it would be between her and Mr. Ducharme about how those funds get disposed of. And the estate wouldn't have anything to say about it.
Well, if it's between her and Mr. Ducharme, meaning they both have a claim on the funds, if Mr. Ducharme dies, his estate goes into, then might also have a claim, right?
Not if he makes her a gift of the money or he provides it to her pursuant to a contract.
If he had done that, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Bond. The case is submitted.
Thank you.
Thank you.